to take a quick break and get back to talking to you. But for people who may not know, tell everybody what Consumer Guide Automotive is.
Yeah, we are consumerguide.com. That's where all our new car and used car reviews live. From there, you can link to the cgdailydrive.com blog. That's where we try to have some fun with car news and car culture. Absolutely worth your time. Lots of fun.
So we're going to talk to Tom about cars and car culture. If you have a question, 312-981-7200. That's how you get a hold of us. Tom, hang on 1 second. We're going to take this quick break, and then we are going to get talking all about cars here on 720 WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio, and we are joined this morning by Tom Appel. We are going to be talking cars. Tom is, he writes for the Daily Blog, and he is the publisher of the Consumer Guide Automotive. And we say again, welcome, Tom.
Thank you.
Let's start with one of the big stories in the automotive industry, the proposed rollbacks of the emission standards. The Obama administration had put in these guidelines that said cars are going to have to be, by 2026, they were hoping to get them up to like 54 miles a gallon. We were trying to cut back emissions. The Trump administration is talking about rolling that back. What does that mean for the automotive industry?
Yeah, this is really interesting, and potentially the impact is huge. The 54.5 standard by the year 2025 was what was proposed by the Obama administration. Not just proposed, that actually became the standard that everyone was shooting for. And it was fairly draconian. There was a lot that manufacturers had to do to meet that standard. And because gasoline or diesel-burning cars weren't going to be able to do that alone, manufacturers were going to have to rely heavily on hybrid and electric vehicles to get to that number. The new number that is being proposed is the number that was going to go into effect at the end of this year, and that is about 37 mpg. And that's the CAFE number. That really translates to more like 28, 29 mpg real world, okay, as the number we see on the window sticker, which is not much higher than where we're at right now. So
Where are we at right now?
The fleet average fuel economy for all cars right now is something like 26 or 27 mpg.
Okay. And can we put that in perspective? Let's say like 10 years ago, what was it? Was it about a big difference, or was it about the same?
Oh, it's improved a lot. 10 years ago, it was probably around 22.
Okay. So we're doing better.
Yes.
But now we don't know. So I'm sorry I interrupted you. So
No.
Theoretically, even though they're saying, 35, that's not going to be what the realistic number is.
Right. One of the things about the CAFE numbers is the CAFE is a constant number since the EPA began measuring fuel economy. The numbers we see on the window sticker of a car, the EPA numbers, have been adjusted four times since then. So we're using different sets of numbers. The actual numbers that we see on the window, the windows are much lower than the CAFE standard. So the 54.5 that we were shooting for translates to something like 39 mpg real world. The 37, which looks like the new standard that's going to be locked in, translates to more like 28 or 29 mpg realistically.
And how is that going to affect the manufacturer of automobiles? You know, is there going to be a drastic change in what they have to do now? Is it going to be easier for the manufacturers?
That's a great question, and we'll see to what extent manufacturers believe that these changes are permanent. And there's been considerable investment in terms of time, money, and engineering into improving the fuel economy of vehicles, and I don't think that any manufacturer is willing to relinquish the gains they've made so far. So I don't think we're going to see anyone just going crazy and all of a sudden slapping huge V8s under the hoods of cars that used to be turbocharged fours. I think we're going to see a very cautious group of auto manufacturers playing this by ear.
Well, haven't we seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, the consumer seems to want cars with better fuel efficiency. I mean, the gas prices keep going up. Where, as a consumer, you want your car to get as many miles per gallon as you can to save that money. So it would seem, environment notwithstanding, that it wouldn't be a smart move for the manufacturers to say, well, okay, like you said, we're going to start dropping big V8s in again.
Yeah, and we know that consumers care because manufacturers advertise those numbers. And it depends on the class of vehicle, too. For luxury vehicles and for larger crossovers, it doesn't seem to matter that much. But small cars and midsize sedans, for example, we see manufacturers advertising their fuel economy. So we know there's a market for vehicles that are easy on the gas.
Now, we know you mentioned before the manufacturers weren't going to be able to hit those higher numbers by themselves, so they were starting to rely on hybrids and things like that. A few years ago, it seemed everybody was talking about hybrids. We were hearing about Prius and all these other hybrids. Everybody was doing hybrids. Electric cars were just starting to move in. You don't hear about them as much anymore. Is that a sign that they weren't successful, or is it just they've been around a while, so now it's not the flavor of the month? They're still selling, but we just don't talk about them.
It's more the latter with an asterisk. One of the things that happened is what we used to call hybrids were at one time there were specific models that had hybrid drivetrains, and they were a little bit more expensive, and they were kind of high tech, and they were kind of gee whiz. But moving forward, most cars are going to be hybrid. There's going to be some sort of we often refer to as electrification. Most vehicles are now going to have some sort of electrification system to improve fuel economy. That's going to be built into the car. They're not going to be advertised as hybrids. It's just going to become sort of standard technology that's just there.
And, you know, with any technology, when it first comes out, it's very expensive. And we've seen the hybrid prices start to drop a little bit. Electric cars, when they first came out, very, very cost prohibitive for some people. Now that seems to be changing a little bit. If the electric attributes become a standard feature, is that going to raise the average price a lot?
The system that's going to be put in place, it's often referred to as a 48-volt system for a number of reasons, is described as having 80% of the effectiveness of a hybrid system for about 20% of the price. Mm-hmm. And by most accounts, that's going to add about $500 to the price of a car.
Okay, in the whole scheme of things, that's not too much.
Not a lot.
You know, when you're buying a new car. Let's talk about electric for a minute. Now, It used to be, when electric first started, people were like, oh, it was all about the environment, all about saving the planet, everything's going to be great. Now, you're looking at Tesla and some of the other luxury electric cars. They're not focusing on the environment. They're focusing on performance. These cars are still going to be, you know, as zippy as any car you've had before, but they're electric.
Yeah, the early adopters of electric vehicles came at both ends of the side. The whole procedure was sort of bipolar, where you had the Mitsubishi i, which was a tiny, affordable little car, and the Nissan Leaf, for example, on the affordable side. But the real interesting stuff included the Tesla Model S, for example. And now Jaguar has the I-Pace that's coming out, and Porsche the Taycan. And I think that for the purposes of helping the public embrace electrification of vehicles, this is probably a really good thing.
Okay.
Because I think that electric cars' reputation for being, you know, extremely bare bones and minimalistic and purely for environmental reasons need not be the case. Electric vehicles can, in fact, be all sorts of fun.
And now, Chevy was doing the Volt. Is that still, you hear mostly about Tesla, and we're going to talk about Tesla after the news, because they're on a big trajectory, but can it be sustained? So we'll talk about that after. But our domestic automakers, we mentioned the performance ones. What are the domestic automakers doing about electric?
Yeah, you mentioned the Volt, and the Volt may be on the way out. That was the extended range electric vehicle that had about 50 miles of range,
okay.
And then it also had a gasoline engine. The Chevrolet Bolt with a B is the big news for that brand right now, and that vehicle is selling very well. They sold about 26,000 of those last year,
And
it wasn't yet available in all 50 states. So this is the year to watch.
And what's the difference? So the Bolt with the B, this is a completely electric engine?
Correct, yeah, with about 240 miles of range.
See, that's good to hear, because, that, as you mentioned, that was the knock on a lot of that. You're not getting a big distance for the battery charge, and then it's like, well, if I get out of the city, where am I going to plug my car in?
Yeah, and the problem was the price of the battery and the packaging of the battery, because a battery that had that kind of range was going to be expensive and difficult to fit into a vehicle.
And now how are we seeing, obviously we are with the Bolt, what's the, as the technology is evolving, where do you see that going? Battery size, is the size going to get smaller as we see with all the other technologies and the range getting longer? That must be the goal, right?
Yeah, the goal is exactly that. The problem is that packaging is still a problem. It's going to be harder to make the battery smaller, but manufacturers have been successful in bringing down the cost of the battery. When the Chevy Volt with a V was introduced for, I think it was 2011, that battery pack cost about $1,000 per kilowatt hour.
Okay.
The battery that's in the Chevy Bolt now is rumored to cost between $100 and $150 per kilowatt hour.
Oh, wow. That is a huge difference.
Huge gains, yeah. Just huge improvement.
Now, the other thing with getting electric cars adopted is the infrastructure to charge them. How is that being addressed by not only, well, I guess by the manufacturers?
Yeah, the manufacturers aren't as involved in that as they should be. They're entering into consortiums to try to encourage municipalities and other organizations to develop these.
Okay.
But for the most part, if you're going to purchase an electric vehicle, it is probably incumbent on you to install a charging station in your house. That's just the best way to do that.
Okay, and then as you said with the new ones, your distance is getting better, so you can go a couple days probably if you're just driving to work and around town. You can go a couple days without a charge. What do you happen to know if I were to install a charging station in my house, like what that might cost?
Yeah, it depends on your house and depends on what's already there wiring-wise.
Okay.
It can be as little as $500 and as much as $1,500, depending on how old your house is and what has to be done.
Holy cow. Tom Appel is our guest. You can, if you have a question, an automotive question for Tom, 312-981-7200. Tom is, of course, the publisher of Consumer Guide, Consumer Guide Automotive, rather. It's consumerguide.com and cgdailydrive.com, where they cover some other stories. I want to talk to you about one of the blogs I read about some of these TV and movie cars that kids love. Because I saw one in particular, and I started singing the theme song to the show that mentions the car. So if you have a question about cars for Tom, 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break and have the news, and then more with Tom on the other side. It's WGN. Brian Noonan in for Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. Nick's on vacation. He will be back next week. I will be with you this week, and I am happy to be here. We are talking all about cars with Tom Appel, who you've heard here with Nick many times. Tom is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. You can go to consumerguide.com or cgdailydrive.com. And do you want to follow Tom on Twitter? Sure you do. It's car_guy_Tom. Welcome back, Tom. Thanks for hanging around. We were talking about, before the break, we were talking about electric cars and the batteries and installing charging stations and things like that. And Cynthia has a question for you about that. Hi, Cynthia.
Oh,
it's Glenn. I'm sorry. It's Glenn. Why does it say Cynthia up there, Dan? Dan is trying
to change my name.
Listen, I'm going to call you Cynthia because you sound sweet, Glenn. So I'm just going to call you Cynthia.
I am married.
Well,
I'm sorry.
All right, then I'll call you Glenn. Go ahead. What question do you have for Tom?
Yeah, the question is, you know, with the electric cars, unless you just drive it around, you know, during the city and plug in at night, are they going to increase the charging time or improve the charging time for electric cars, like if you want to take it to a, you know, cross-country trip? What's the time now it takes to charge an electric car?
That's a really good question, and the answer is a little bit complicated. Charging times can't really be improved using level 2 stations, which is the station you might install in your house, or level 1 station, which would be just plug it into a wall outlet, because you're basically charging as fast as you can given the infrastructure that supports those two methods. What's faster is something called level 3 or DC fast charging. You would need to do that off-site someplace, and hopefully you will start seeing chargers like that at gas stations or at rest stops on the highway or something like that. A level 3 charger, and it depends a lot on what standard we actually end up with, should be able to charge a car 80% of the way in about half an hour. And then,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the rest of that takes a little bit longer because you have to balance the cells and you have some complicated stuff happening. But that's the hope, that those are going to become common. And really, if you think about it, half an hour, if you're stopping, you use the restroom, you go in and pick up a Pepsi, that's probably not outrageous.
Yeah, half hour doesn't seem
too bad. No. You know, I was just thinking, why don't they go ahead and embed like a solar panel on the top of the car to help with the charging? Or maybe they've thought about it. I don't know. To help the charging time.
Now that's an interesting. That's an interesting, interesting question. Have they? Is there enough power from a solar panel, Tom?
No, there isn't. That's actually the situation.
Ah.
There was a vehicle that was sold for a couple of years, known as the Fisker Karma, that had a solar panel roof, and it was determined that over the life of the car, the solar panel would contribute about one full charge.
Oh, that's not enough.
Wow.
Well,
that's not enough. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Glenn. Cynthia, we appreciate the call. All right, so let's stay on electric, Tom, because we mentioned Tesla before, and everybody when they think electric and they think luxury and performance, oh man, they think about Tesla. And reports are coming out, Tesla, they're burning through money. They're pushing their employees too hard. Things may not be as rosy for Tesla as. Obviously, they hoped, and maybe other people hoped as well.
Yeah, the funny thing about Tesla, it seems like they're always at a crossroads, and that yet they always seem to somehow march on to the next crossroad. So, but yes, things do seem very dire for them right now. They lost about $800 million in the last quarter, and they're at a point now where they think they can get manufacturing of the Model 3, their new small car, up to their promised 6,000 units per week. Wow. Now, there's a couple of interesting things about that, and one is that I think that buyers are starting to disappear for that vehicle. When they'd announced the Model 3, of course, it was promised that it was going to be about $35,000,
okay.
And they famously picked up 400 or 500,000 deposits of $1,000 each for that vehicle. In fact, the vehicles they're building are selling between $50,000 and $75,000. And I don't think that the demand is as strong as we're being led to believe it is for that vehicle. And they're hoping to build 6,000 of those a week. And I'm not sure there is 300,000 buyers out there for that vehicle.
Not if you promise a vehicle at 35 and now the price is almost 70.
Right.
The people, you know, no, that seems excessive. So if you're projecting ahead, what do you think the future looks like for them?
I don't know. It's complicated because the other problem that Tesla has and that General Motors is about to have is that they've run out of federal tax credits. That means that the $7,500 tax credit that many buyers of electric vehicles have been enjoying will not apply to Tesla after the end of this model year. It's going to be cut in half, I think, for 6 months, fall in half again after that, and then disappear.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of the incentive for purchasing an electric from Tesla is going to disappear.
Okay. And if the prices keep going up, and they, you know, that doesn't bode well for any business.
No, absolutely not.
If your demand starts to drop. Let's talk about the big three automakers and the fact that crossover vehicles from foreign competition are starting to really take a big bite out of their market share. How are Ford, Chrysler, GM, how are they going to respond to this? And for those who are unfamiliar, Tom, first explain what a crossover is, and then, you know, we'll go into how the U.S. manufacturers are going to battle the foreign manufacturers for this segment.
Yeah, this is an interesting story, and the story I think we're talking about first appeared in Bloomberg, and mm-hmm. it sort of addressed shrinking U.S. market share in the crossover segment. And yeah, it's good to know what a crossover is. When the American makers started selling the Ford Explorer, for example, back in 1991, that was actually an SUV. It was an old-school truck-style vehicle.
Right.
It used body-on-frame construction. It was big, it was heavy, and not especially efficient. Since that time, we can think of vehicles like the Lexus RX 300, the Toyota Highlander, as sort of early examples of crossovers where they used car technology to build these truck-like vehicles. The result was a vehicle that was slightly lower, it was lighter, it was more fuel efficient, and it rode and handled much better.
Mm-hmm. And that's so anything like now. I have a Hyundai Santa Fe Sport, so would that be considered a crossover?
Yes, that is okay. Exactly. That's smack in the middle of that market.
Perfect. Okay. So now we're getting Honda's the market leader in that, from what I read. And you've got, as I said, Hyundai, but everybody seems to have one of these. Who are the leading manufacturers in that segment in the US automakers, and how can the US automakers improve to get a bigger share of that market?
Yeah, I want to throw a caveat out on these statistics real quick, if I may.
Sure.
the article we're discussing actually talked about how the U.S. once had 60% of that market, and now I guess is projected to have something like 35 to 40% of that market. That 35 to 40% is not too far off of the domestic maker's market share.
Okay.
So it's kind of close to where they should be, maybe a little bit behind, but I think that this article may have sort of overstated the drama that is here.
Ah, okay.
And additionally, we're going to see some more vehicles coming from the domestic makers, although we're going to see more from the imports as well. But it's worth knowing now that Jeep essentially sells only crossovers. They're growing like crazy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, people can't get enough Cherokees. I don't know what the deal is.
Because they're a higher price than a lot of the other vehicles in that class. What is it that makes that Cherokee so popular? Any ideas?
Well, it's not a bad vehicle, so let's start right there.
All right.
But I think that the Jeep Cachet is just incredibly valuable, and just not in the U.S., but in other markets as well.
Okay.
Jeep is doing well in even in Europe and in South America. So, yeah, Jeep does an incredible job of branding itself, and it now has cars in the subcompact, compact, and midsize segments. I shouldn't say cars. I should say crossovers. But that's very much an American crossover success story.
So if you were looking for a crossover, you know, are the better ones from Honda and the foreign makers, or what are the good domestic crossovers?
The good domestic crossovers. I am fond right now of the Chevrolet Equinox, which was downsized slightly last year. It went from a midsize to a largish compact vehicle. That's very nice. The Ford Escape. If you're looking for a domestic crossover, it's available with three different engines. Very sporty. Also, the Jeep Grand Cherokee, if you want something that's sort of high-endy with all sorts of cachet and real off-road cred, that's not a bad way to go.
Well, let's compare those that you mentioned domestic to all of them. Where would you rank some of the crossovers? Would Honda still be the best? I mean, it's the best-selling according to these stories.
Yeah, you know, the Honda Pilot is sort of, if you have five people to move around, that is a great crossover. That's how this midsize crossover sells very well. The Toyota Highlander, also five passenger, can go seven passenger if you need it to. That's a very refined, reasonably affordable vehicle. Like that a lot. The Nissan Rogue, which is a compact crossover, that's very popular.
Yeah, I see a lot of those.
Yeah, that's selling very well. That's a nice vehicle. A lot of vehicle for the money.
Now, where would you put the other car I see a lot, and my wife has one, and I saw like four today when I stopped at Target, are those Kia Souls. What class does that fit into? Is that a crossover? Is it just a compact car? What is it?
That's a tough one. We call it a subcompact crossover. Subcompact car. And the reason we don't call it a crossover is because it doesn't have the ride height, and it's not available with all-wheel drive.
Ah, and those are the two components that make something a crossover?
Generally. It depends on who's doing the defining, but we tend to, at Consumer Guide, look for all-wheel drive if we can get it. We love the Soul. We usually make it a Best Buy each year, but not quite a crossover.
I'm very happy with that. I'm 6'5", and for a guy my size, it's pretty comfortable. I mean, to ride in the passenger seat or to drive it, I was surprised when she got it. I was like, oh, no, it's not going to be good at all. And this is actually her second one.
Yeah, that's the miracle of the Soul. It's the chair height seating. I'm about 6'1" and well over 300 pounds, and the Soul passes what I call the four Tom test, and then you could put four of me in that car comfortably.
Yeah, it's amazing. Let me ask you this: when I was looking at my car's a couple years old, when I was looking for it, and you mentioned this before, why do these manufacturers? They've got a, let's say, a midsize crossover, but they give you three different engines. So you don't know, you know, as a guy who's doesn't know a lot about cars, I did my research and stuff, but then it's like, well, you know, you make it with the four-cylinder, is that enough? Well, do you get the turbo? Do you go up, do you pay the a lot more to get the six-cylinder? I don't understand why they have this one car, but then they can give you three different engines.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you had to decide between a largest four-cylinder or a smaller turbo four.
Yes.
Which can be confusing for shoppers. Part of the reason is to hit certain price points. You'll find that in a lot of vehicles, there's an upgrade engine that's more power. The Honda Accord, for example, is available with a 1.5 or 2-liter turbo. trying to think what else. The Chevrolet Equinox has the exact same offering, a 1.5 or a 2-liter turbo. And it's just an upgrade that comes with higher trim levels generally.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a standalone option, but not as much now as it used to be.
Okay, so they just package it. And does it change things that much? Does it change if we can use my car as an example? It's the Santa Fe Sport, and I got the turbo. Now, you know, I was hesitant about a 4-cylinder to begin with a vehicle that size. It's not huge, but it's not tiny. And it seems to be fine. And the turbo, I can tell when I need to pass on the interstate, it kicks in and off I go. Is there that much of a difference for somebody who doesn't really know cars to say, all right, I got the basic 4-cylinder, or I got the turbo, or I upgraded to the 6-cylinder?
There might not be, and it depends on the kind of driving you do. If you just drive around the city, a lot of vehicles with smaller or lower power engines are geared so that they're reasonably quick from 0 to 10 or 0 to 20 miles an hour, which is really what you need to get around from stoplights or to just catch up with traffic.
Yeah.
But a lot of the smaller cars like that will really let you down on ramps and in passing.
Yes.
And that's where you might be glad you have the turbo. So if you spend a lot of time on the highway, the bigger or higher performance engine might pay off for you.
Okay, and that's something that people go through, you know, whenever they're buying a vehicle. What have you been driving lately? What have you been test driving lately?
Speaking of small vehicles,
yes.
With small engines, I just drove and really liked the Hyundai Kona. This is Hyundai's new subcompact crossover, speaking of foreign crossovers.
Yes.
And it's really very interesting looking. It's available with two-tone paint schemes that make it very hip and modern and youthful. The one I drove was red with a black top, but I drove a very base version with front drive. Came to just $22,000, and I really liked it. Had the opportunity to pack my family in it and drive to Wisconsin for the weekend, and we were quite comfortable.
I'm looking at a picture of it now. It looks very jazzy. It almost reminds me of the Rogue a little bit.
That's close to the segment where it plays. There's a Rogue Sport that's a little bit smaller that competes pretty closely with that. And then Nissan just came out with a vehicle called the Kicks, which is even smaller.
Oh, geez. Now, at what point does a tiny little crossover just become a regular old compact car?
Well, this is one of those cases with front-wheel drive that it's almost hard to call it a crossover, but it is available with all-wheel drive. It does have some ride height, and we're always looking for that seating position, too, because one of the things that people look for in a crossover, whether they know it or not, is a certain amount of ride height so that they can see over traffic.
Yes, exactly. That's the key, and it's funny, when you haven't driven a car with that kind of height, you don't really know the difference, but once you drive a car that's up a little bit, you never really want to go back.
No, that's so true.
It makes it crazy difficult. Tom Appel is my guest. He is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, consumerguide.com, also cgdailydrive.com, where they do all different kind of blogs about all different kind of fun stories, which we are going to talk about in a minute. If you want to follow Tom on Twitter, it's car_guy_Tom. Tom, if you can hang on, we will be right back after we do this break, and we will talk some more cars. If you have a question for Tom, 312-981-7200 is how you get a hold of us. We'll get more car talk after this. WGN. All right, we are talking cars with Tom Appel. He's the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. He writes for the Daily Drive. You can go to consumerguide.com or cgdailydrive.com. And Tom, we had somebody text in because we were talking about different kind of cars and you know, the better this or that. Somebody wants to know your picks for GMC products, something a little larger. So on the large end of the GMC, what are the vehicles you would recommend?
Oh, well, in the crossover range, there are two biggish ones. There's the GMC Acadia. Mm-hmm. That's their new midsize car that was redesigned last year. Mm-hmm. And there's the GMC, there's the Acadia, and that was just downsized, forgive me. And then you go up to the full-size body-on-frame vehicle, which would be the Yukon.
Okay.
You have to need the Yukon to want to get that. If you need the towing, you need the serious off-road ability, or you just need the ability to carry heavy loads, you could do that. But the Acadia is very nice. It's a 5-passenger car, sort of competes with the Jeep Grand Cherokee. I like it a lot.
Okay, so there you go, the GMC Acadia. Bill has a question for you about car feel. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Tom. I just traded in a 2006 Chrysler Pacifica. It had a four-speed transmission, and it coasted forever. I take my foot off the accelerator, coast and coast. I got a new 2018 nine-speed Atlas, and when I begin to coast, I can feel the transmission downshifting. It's very annoying. I don't feel it upshifting, but as I'm coasting, it goes from 7, 6, 5, 4, and it feels like I've got the foot on my brake. Is there anything you can do about that, or is that just a typical of a nine-speed or eight-speed?
You can check and see. If enough people have decided that that feels weird, that there is some sort of software update for it. But I suspect there is not. And what you probably imagine to be the problem is the problem, and that's that 9 speeds and 10 speeds can be a little bit busier than 4 speeds once were. And so there's just a little bit more activity as you're accelerating and decelerating. Some people like that. They think it feels sporty. Other people, like you, are like, this feels a little strange to me.
Yeah. Good luck, Bill.
I often wondered why they do that. It seems to be best to be left in a high gear for a long time rather than shifting down to low gears as you're slowing down. Why, isn't that more efficient to be in a high gear?
It would be, and you might end up with some coasting action eventually, but one of the things that the car wants to do is have it in a gear that you're going to need as you're decelerating so that it doesn't take that long to get to the gear when you do hit the gas.
Understood.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. Tom, forgive my ignorance, or don't. What's a 9-speed? I haven't heard that term before.
Yeah, we're talking about transmissions. And if you're my age, yes. I'm 53 years old, you probably drove a car with a 3-speed automatic when you took driver's edge. That's what all automatics were.
Right, and then I've had manual transmissions, but those were, what, 4-speed?
4 speeds, 5 speeds, now 6 speeds.
Okay.
Are common. But automatics have gone up in gear count dramatically recently, and this is in the name largely in fuel economy. So they went to 4 speeds and then 5 and 6 speeds, some 7 speeds, but 8, 9, and 10 speeds are becoming common now.
Oh, wow. All right. Is that all classes of vehicles or just certain ones?
Eventually all classes of vehicles. Yeah, they're becoming common.
Okay. I wanted to talk about one of the blogs on the Daily Drive, which people can get at cgdailydrive.com. It was about the live action really cool cars from kids shows, and it's fun because it started me thinking not only the ones you listed, but then, you know, of course, I started thinking about the Batmobile and the Dukes of Hazzard car and even, all these kind of things. Cars have always played a big part in pop culture, right? I mean, in kids, they market these cool cars on kid shows and then hopefully hook kids on to want to go out shopping for cars. Because I wanted a banana buggy, man. I wanted to be one of the banana splits.
I've been drawn to shows with cars for as long as I can remember, and then that's how I became a Rockford Files fan. I just loved that Firebird.
Yeah, the Firebird, and then you had Magnum, of course, with the Ferrari. But and then who had the Fall Guy had the Trans Am with the big bird on the hood? Wasn't that the Fall Guy?
And then he also had a I think a GMC pickup.
Yes. And there was I remember some show that I watched had an El Camino. That was the big thing. And, of course, then there was the General Lee on the Dukes of Hazzard. So cars were always the focal point of these shows where you'd go, oh, I got to have a car like that. And you'd never have the General Lee ever. It'd be sad. But I didn't remember some of these shows that you had on there. Now, I remembered Electrowoman and Dinah Girl, just the name of the show. I didn't really remember the car. But the Arc 2, I did not remember that show at all.
Yeah, that was a short-lived show, and deservedly so, because it was really preachy. it was a bunch of young people perusing the landscape after some sort of post-apocalyptic disaster caused by human neglect of the planet.
Oh, boy. Is that why they traveled with a monkey?
Yeah, I think it was. I believe it was a talking monkey, but the vehicle they traveled in was so cool. The Arc 2, it was called.
But for a group of environmental warriors who were driving around in this giant Arc 2, they had another car inside. It's like, oh, wow, you're really, killing two birds with your two stones. You've got this giant truck and then another truck that pops out of it. That doesn't seem very environmentally friendly.
I had never considered that, but no, they do seem to be wasting a lot of fuel.
You know, just take the Arc and drive the Arc around. Well, listen, Tom, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. People can go to consumerguide.com or cgdailydrive.com, and then they need to follow you on Twitter, car_guy_Tom. It was great talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Well, thank you very much. I had fun.
Take care, Tom. We'll see you later.
Take care.
All right, that's Tom Appel. Again, you can follow him at car_guy_Tom and go to consumerguide.com and cgdailydrive.com. Let's do this, and then it's news time.